Oh, God, you're not drinking? Oh, don't be so boring. Oh, you're ruining everything. Oh, go on, we were meant to be having a nice night out. Suddenly, your simple choice, I'm not drinking, three simple words, can be like everyone else's night is ruined as a result. And that just seems crazy when you actually take a step back and look at what's really going on.
A familiar sounding scenario for many people who, for whatever reason, choose not to drink. And that's why we're talking in this week's Real Podcast, brought to you by Real Kombucha, with Ruby Warrington. Formerly the features editor on the Sunday Times Style magazine, Ruby has recently written Sober Curious, a fascinating book that offers a non-preachy take on our relationship with alcohol. Through her own experience, she details the benefits she has discovered from unlearning what she calls the mindless habit of drinking and pursuing the possibilities offered by a sober curious lifestyle. And as you'll hear, that doesn't necessarily mean giving up alcohol entirely, but instead taking an active interest in what a sober life might offer to you. We met up in central London to find out where the sober curious life has led Ruby so far.
You were mentioning to me before the interview that sober curiosity has been something that you've been talking about for, what, 3-4 years?
Outwardly vocalising, encouraging other people to get sober curious for about 3.5-4 years, I suppose. I think I wrote a blog post for my blog about being sober curious in the summer of 2015, maybe? So, yeah, I don't know the exact dates, but personally... So my definition of what it means to be sober curious is to really to question, literally question, every impulse, every invitation or every expectation to drink, whether it's on your behalf or in the eyes of others, rather than just kind of blindly going along with the dominant drinking culture. And so based on that description, I have been sober curious for about 8 or 9 years now. Like really just bringing this questioning mindset, this curiosity to... all the different situations I found myself expected to drink. So yeah, it's been quite a long journey, I suppose. And the lessons learned and experiences along the way are all shared in my new book. And it's been very interesting to witness this what began as such a personal thing now really begin to blossom, and I see so many other people getting sober curious too. It's really fascinating. And I was always, you know, when I wrote for magazines, I was always most interested in writing those kind of zeitgeisty social trend pieces. And I think I've always just had quite an antenna for what's in the kind of public mood, I suppose. And this was definitely not something that I approached in a calculated way, like what's going to be the next trend in drinking. It was just very much like feeling very attuned to my own instinct about just this kind of this mindless drinking culture that we've been consumed by for probably the latter half of the 20th century up to now. It just feels, it just started to feel out of alignment with our values collectively, as well as my values as a person. So, yeah, it's a personal story and mission and quest, I suppose, and that reflects a much bigger shift societally.
Yeah, and you were... Again, if you were to pick up the book and read the book, then obviously, certainly straight away you get the sense that it's definitely not a zeitgeisty thing, because it is something that you've lived, right? You actually came to it. I mean, again, we've talked a little about the similarities, but I think, you know, starting off in your book, you talk about sort of, you know, being in Camden and sort of in the Ladette culture and that kind of thing. And, you know, while I wasn't part of the Ladette culture, I was certainly in Camden in the mid-90s. And
you would have been part of the male equivalent, which was the nuts, loaded mag. Like, similarly, it was very much about, you know, this life of debauchery being a kind of badge of honour in a way, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And, yes, that sort of Britpop era where all of your sort of icons were heavy drinkers, your Liam Gallagher's and your Graham Coxon's and all of that lot.
Exactly. Have you read Kill Your Friends?
Yes.
That really typifies in a very like exaggerated, like bombastic sort of a way, the whole kind of culture, this culture of excessive consumption.
Yeah.
And it was a reflection of kind of excessive consumption that was happening in terms of material goods as well. It's like, it's all wrapped up in the same vibe.
There's a really interesting quote. Let me just find it.
You know, you talk a little bit about the idea of sort of the modern woman at that time being sort of emancipated by having a pint of beer in their hands and that kind of thing. So what do you think happened to the Ladette?
Oh, the Ladette maybe overindulged a bit and had to kind of go, what's going on here? It's funny, like someone sent me a picture of Zoe Ball from that era the other day, yeah. And she's like kind of my doppelganger in many ways, particularly when we were both like that age. And I think Zoe Ball doesn't drink now. And it's just like, I think that when drinking to excess has been your norm, I think there naturally will come a point, whether it's your classic kind of like rock bottom that we hear about often, in terms of people's recovery stories, or whether it's a subtler rock bottom, which might look like just an inability to feel optimistic about life, or feeling like just really pissed off and angry that your entire weekend, every weekend, is given over to hangovers and recovery. You never get some actual real time off. Like, you know, there are degrees of sort of crisis point, I suppose. But I think for anyone who's been drinking to excess for a prolonged period of time, you'll reach some kind of a crisis point that's like, no more, I just can't continue with this, you know? And for some people, like for a long, long time, the only sort of like languaging or the only path that we've been presented with, if you reach that point, is, well, there's AA for you and you're an alcoholic and you have this label and that's a done deal and goodbye.
Yeah.
And I never really felt that was very fair, actually. Fair isn't the right word. It didn't feel to me inclusive enough. And I felt that for myself and many people in my community, in my, you know, my peer group, were having this questioning with alcohol, but didn't necessarily see themselves as alcoholics or candidates for a 12-step program. And so the sober curious idea came about as like, well, what happened if we all just talked about this really openly? Perhaps we'd find some other solutions. Like, that's how we, you know, collaboration is how we breed ingenuity and progress in a way. So it's like, let's actually just talk about what's going on here and see what comes out of it.
Yeah. But the alcoholic point is a really interesting point, because I think obviously you will know, and anybody who tries to take a break from drinking for whatever reason will know that doing so comes with a huge amount of inquisition. So you can't go to a pub with your friends without being almost treated slightly as a sort of pariah. And one of the things that I always find having to explain is that I wasn't an alcoholic. There's no description for myself.
Right.
The only description for myself comes with a lot of explaining that tends to be, I didn't wake up in the morning desperate for a drink, but I couldn't go out to a bar without having four, sort of thing.
Right. There's this grey area, which there isn't really language around it, and I'm still making up. People will often say to me, so are you sober now? And I say, well, I'm not sober, but I don't drink. Because even the word sober has so many connotations. If I said I was sober, people would automatically assume, and I may well be implying, I would actually feel like I was implying that I'm completely abstinent from alcohol, because I'm recovering from alcoholism, the disease of alcoholism. And that's not my story. I'm not sober. And I may occasionally have a sip of wine and a toast at a wedding. And that I wouldn't consider that a relapse, whereas if I was sober, that might be termed a relapse. It would have all these other kind of implications. So yeah, it's complicated, and I think there needs to be even more language around it, which is kind of what I'm attempting to stimulate by having this discussion.
And it's yes, and I think again what comes across a lot in the book, and this is obviously attached to what you do in other parts of your life, but there's a lot of conversation there that overlaps very much with what you might call mindfulness, I suppose. I mean, I think the idea of sort of having stories is a fascinating one. You know, you go out and you have to present a story for whatever reason you feel pressured to present a story as to why you aren't drinking.
Yeah.
But actually, you're presenting that story to yourself on a daily basis.
Yeah. There isn't a succinct way of phrasing it, right? I'm a human being, and that means I'm biologically very susceptible to becoming dependent on alcohol, which is a beverage which meets many of my biological needs in terms of my emotional needs, right? I talk in the book about this, a quote from a brilliant book called The Biology of Desire by a guy called Mark Lewis, who's a former opioids addict turned brain scientist. So he can really speak to kind of like what's actually going on in our brain when we develop an attachment to something. The subhead is Why Addiction is Not a Disease. which is highly controversial, but like without controversy, again, how do we have progress?
Yeah.
Anyway, he talks about, you know, the desire function of our brain means that we're biologically hardwired to seek out and repeat any experience that either brings us pleasure or takes away our pain. Mm. And alcohol, on a very superficial level, can appear to do both those things. And so, yeah, as a human being who has, with a complicated life, very hard not to become, especially considering the, you know, the billions of pounds of advertising and marketing revenue that are spent by the alcohol industry every year to make sure that we continue to perceive alcohol as the answer to when we desire pleasure or when we are feeling pain, you know? So, yeah, really hard not to become dependent on it. So my, what am I? I'm a human being. I'm a fallible human being.
Yeah.
Who happens to live in a culture where, you know, alcohol is celebrated.
Yeah, and we'll come on to that, because I think finally that we're starting to see real change in that kind of area. But
definitely,
before we go there, I mean, just some of those questions that I think are really worth sort of emphasising, because I think people who listen to this will resonate with them. I mean, I think things like you ask these questions: how come I feel like an outsider, a weirdo? I thought this was an interesting one. How I sometimes feel like I'm a problem to other people if I don't drink. So I mean, that's, without wanting to sort of paraphrase the book entirely, how do you go about answering some
Well yeah questions? I mean, this is really about the peer pressure piece, right? And like you were saying, when the group activity is drinking, and for many of us in our society, we grow up in a culture where most of our group activities outside of sporting occasions revolve around alcohol. And then by the time the sports have actually finished, there's usually drink. It's like, how many of my friends have run a marathon and the first thing they do is go to the pub? You know, it's just kind of, by simply saying, I'm not going to drink, you're marking yourself as an outsider. And that can be very uncomfortable. Again, we're biologically hardwired to want to fit in, to want to be accepted, to not want to make ourselves stand out or be other or different. And then, yeah, so of course, you marking yourself as different by saying, I'm not drinking, immediately then is a mirror for everybody else to look at their drinking. You become a mirror for them to examine their own drinking habits in.
Absolutely.
And that will mean that you are going to have all of their insecurities and their own subconscious questions about that being projected onto you. And that's a really uncomfortable place to willingly put yourself.
Yeah.
And in fact, you must be familiar with 1 year no beer.
Yes.
So they were telling me about some research they did recently, which showed that for 93% of people in their survey said that peer pressure was actually the number one reason that they shied away from or chose not to take a break from drinking or chose not to, you know, even stop completely. Just not wanting to have to be answering all those questions. Yeah. And the thing about being a problem for other people when you don't drink, the number of times, and thankfully, you know, perhaps it's the way that I've approached it, but my close friends have never really made me feel this way, but I've heard it from lots of other people. Oh God, you're not drinking. Oh, don't be so boring. Oh, you're ruining everything. Oh, go on, we were meant to be having a nice night out. Suddenly your simple choice, I'm not drinking, three simple words can be like everyone else's night is ruined as a result. And that just seems crazy when you actually take a step back and look at what's really going on.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I think it comes down to, as you say, the ingrained, you know, sort of culture, certainly in this country. I mean, I think another thing that sort of resonated from reading your book is the fact that you were introduced to alcohol at the age of 8.
I've seen other people give their 3-year-old child, oh, a sip of beer, isn't it funny? Oh, look, he's having a sip of beer.
Yeah,
it's kind of seen as quite normal. And I think my parents, my dad in particular, thought he was doing the responsible thing by not making alcohol this kind of glamorous, exotic, forbidden fruit that I would then binge on as soon as I was old enough or looked old enough to acquire it. He thought he was kind of like, but the hidden implication in that is that it was inevitable that I would become a drinker.
Yeah.
It was inevitable that I would be a drinker.
Yeah.
It's just like, ease her in gently rather than like, you know, make it this, like I said, this forbidden fruit that then becomes something that I binged on or did to excess. I ended up doing that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar. I don't know what age I would have been, but I think most people probably have some kind of memory of a similar ilk. Just being allowed to try wine at the table.
Exactly.
And then, I don't know, you know, I think I have a vivid memory of probably being about 11 and going to a family party at my mum's family in Liverpool and everybody drinking and you almost being expected to have shandy.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So my version of shandy, which I write about in the book, I discovered at some kind of a family picnic. Lilt. Do you remember Lilt?
Of course.
I don't think we have Lilt anymore, do we?
I can't picture it, seeing it anywhere.
It's quite delicious, though.
Lilt. Quite sugary.
Mixed with white wine. I was making my own Alco Pops at the age of, like, probably 9 or 10.
Yeah. No wonder.
No wonder. And that's not to say, you know, this is not about, again, very important, this is not about placing blame on parents or society or anyone for, like, this is just the way things are. It's not, like, for me, the sober curious question is not a conversation. It's not about anything being right or wrong or good or bad. It's just about acknowledging what's actually happening and then cultivating enough trust and self-awareness and, like, self-belief in a way to be able to know it's okay to make choices that feel good for you no matter what's going on around you, you know, no matter what the pressures might be.
In your Sober Curious book, and as somebody who's promoting sober curiousness, you're not preaching in any way. When people hear people talking about not drinking, they, as you say, it's a mirror being held up to them quite often, and so the natural reaction is often to become slightly defensive and to feel as though, oh God, they're harping on about that again or whatever. And it's absolutely not that, is it? I mean, the word curious sort of takes you away from that in the first place. How do you balance that fine line between sort of a largely non-alcoholic lifestyle and preaching about it?
I try to show, not tell, you know, just model it, just by modelling by behaviour. I would never see it as my place to tell anybody, you know what, you're probably drinking a bit too much. That would never, you know, that has happened maybe in one occasion. A close friend was going through a very difficult time in his marriage, and I made the subtle suggestion, you know, if you're really confused about this, maybe taking a break from the drinking, it's really helped me in situations to just feel more clear and to feel more confident. And so offering advice, but in that same breath, bringing it back to, because in my experience, this has been really helpful, you know, just being super selective. Because actually I'm also like, yeah, alcohol ended up presenting as a problem for me, but there are tons of people who drink as much as I did who've never experienced it as a problem, and that's fine. You know, it's not it's about always bringing it back to my own experience and really just modelling, like, life's great without wanting to appear smug, like, yeah.
So going back to that sort of the idea that there's a sort of a generational thing. At the moment, we've got this new generation of non-drinkers. You know, amazing stats around about 30% of Londoners now between ages 18 and 24 claim to be teetotal. The other day, it's huge, yeah. And the other day, I was reading that 38% of students now in Britain don't drink. I don't know what they're doing.
38%?
According to a report that I read the other day.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think the sort of sober curious movement, certainly it resonates with me because I come from that age group where we were, you know, as we said before, life was seen as better if you were pissed up and having it large or whatever the terminology was back then. And that's just not the case now. So, you know, at Real Kombucha, we work with a lot of younger people who it's much more about life being about experiences and that kind of thing. And, you know, that Instagram phrase, you know, hashtag living your best life is quite, you know, one that...
It's funny, though, because we would have thought that living your best life meant cocktails on the beach at sunset in Ibiza.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's just what constitutes what is best life. There's a shift in values, which is the larger piece I was talking about. We've moved away, I think, from this idea that overconsumption or conspicuous consumption is a status symbol. It actually kind of seems a bit sad and a bit... selfish, and it's not very, you know, it just doesn't fit with our overall more sort of like collaborative, nurturing, collective mentality in general now, you know?
Yeah. Well, you use a phrase, I think the phrase was something like living a more vital life or something like that. Is that something? Have I got that wrong?
I might have used something like that. It sounds a bit hashtag wellness for me, and I'm not really into that as well. I really don't like the best life. I don't like this hierarchical terminology that implies some life is better than another. Because actually that's just, no, I'm not living a better life than anyone else. I'm living a life that's right for me.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I don't like it purely because it sounds like marketing speak.
Right, yeah,
but
exactly.
I think if you had to have any kind of hashtag around that kind of thing, I quite like the idea of something being a bit more about living, maybe not vital life, but the idea that you can do a little more with your life, that you can experience a lot more if you're not drinking.
I prefer, for example, the term conscious drinking than mindful drinking.
Right.
Because for me, I want to be conscious. Like, choosing consciousness means like awakeness, awareness, like being really like just aware of what's happening in the world and how I can respond and interact with it. That to me is the kind of life I want, you know. But I love the fact that you're called real kombucha. It's about an authentic life for me as well. So an authentic life meaning a life that's aligned with my values and what feels good to me.
Back in New York, because you're based in the States, aren't you? I mean, you've got your clubbed soda, which is not the same as London's club soda.
No, we call it Club Soda NYC,
right,
specifically to get around that. But yes, we've been doing the Club Soda NYC events for just over three years now. We always have a different theme at the events, and generally we'll either have featured speakers or a panel discussion on the theme. We may have some kind of like interactive activities to get people talking. But the whole point of that was really to bring this conversation out of the closet and actually make it like the focus of an event, getting people together in a social way where we actually were specifically saying this is about not drinking and it's not about being at an AA meeting, you know. This is about a different approach to not drinking. We've had dance parties, we had a boozeless brunch, we've had all sorts of different fun ways for people to get together.
And the book itself, you're here to promote it, is that right? Is that why you're in London at the moment?
Yes. Not surprisingly, actually, the press response to the book in the UK was really, really great. And so it just felt like a good time to come over and, do a bit of a launch here, you know? It's my hometown. Did most of my most excessive drinking here. And it's really it's very curious to me how, like you were saying, you know, the alcohol-free movement has moving at warp speed here, and I want to see what's going on here.
Is that the same in the States?
Definitely picking up speed, but the States is so big and in a way so segregated. Like, a mass movement I think will take longer to gain traction in the US in a way, because there are so many different pockets and so many different things happening. But yeah, it's certainly, I mean, our events, we started our first event, we probably had 70 people. The last one we had over 200, which is, maybe that's just because more people know about it, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, it also speaks to the fact that more people are interested in this idea of sober socialising.
I think, to go back to the point that London's growing at such a, or the UK, sorry, not London specific, the UK is growing at such a speed, has to do with choice. And, you know, before we turned the tape on here, we were talking a lot about things not being black and white, and it being a case in the foodie world, you're looking at people being much more interested in having a veg-centric approach, or certainly giving people those options. I mean, I always joke, but it's not really much of a joke, that when I came to university in London in the mid-90s, I remember, you know, it being unusual to find an avocado in a Tesco's or something like that. The choice that we have now, both in drinking and eating, has to have an effect on that, don't you think?
Definitely. And you would expect the same in America, though, right?
Yeah.
However, another reason I think it's gaining traction faster here is that alcohol is just more interwoven into everyday life here. So whether that means more people have found themselves at that crisis point of, hold on, I'm drinking a bottle of wine a night, how did that happen? No, got to pull back. In the US, I see a lot more like hard liquor on a Friday night, and that's how people drink, and there's less kind of pressure to drink wine with dinner during the week. And yeah. I really noticed when I first moved there, no one would ever order a bottle of wine in a restaurant. It would always be ordered by the glass, and I think that just speaks volumes for the kind of... If I was going out for dinner with a friend here, it would be a bottle of wine, of course, between the two of us. Just of course. But there, that would be seen as very excessive on a weeknight, on a work night, right? But yeah. they will drink heavily, and they'll do lots of shots and, you know, hard liquor when it's time to drink. They go for it harder. And I think, and that's kind of like in cities like New York. And then across the rest of America, it's such a driving culture. A lot more drinking happens at home. And so there's not really this social drinking situation, right? There's a lot more drinking behind closed doors, and so I think alcoholism is a huge problem there, of course, but there's not been such a consumer demand and need for other options in bars, because people who are, yeah, a lot more people I think are drinking at home. It's been really interesting, because even alcohol-free beer, there's hardly any alcohol-free beer brands in America. I'm like, please, BrewDog, bring me Nanny State. Like, please.
Well, hopefully we'll get over there eventually.
Yes. You know, there's quite a lot of kombucha. Kombucha has exploded off the back of the whole kind of like healthy eating, gut health trend that's been huge there for a while. There's a lot of kombucha now.
I always talk about it in this way, that you can take a grape and you could turn a grape into a schlur, so a sort of sugary soft drink, or you could turn a grape into a champagne or a very fine wine. Neither of those things are any better or worse than the other. They're just different drinking occasions. And in the same way that you can take tea, you can ferment tea, and you can ferment tea into something that's a health drink. You can ferment tea, you can add flavours to it and turn it into a flavoured soft drink. Or, similarly, you can take great tea and you can ferment it into something that doesn't require flavouring and actually suits non-alcoholic drinking occasions. And that was really... That's, I speak, I think, the differentiator between what we're doing and other brands. So.
Yeah, right, absolutely. I actually tried some unflavoured kombucha in Berlin recently. My brother had been working in a restaurant there. I went to check it out with him. The guy who's running the bar was making his own kombucha there, and it was unflavoured, and it was so delicious and subtle compared to what I'm used to in the States. They're all about all the flavours and the maximum different combos. Like, there's a pink lady and basil is one of my favourites. Really, like, that is all about like what's new and novel and next, and like CBD kombucha is now like the next thing. But I like the subtleness of this, and it feels like this feels like to me like a genuine alternative to a glass of wine. Whereas a lot of those heavily flavoured ones feel much more like it's an alternative to a Coke or a lemonade or, like a more flavoured soft drink.
Well, you've said all the right things, so you've got the job.
But no, I mean, we're tasting it now and I can still smell it. It's got that sort of... It's got a really delicious... Like, for example, one of the reasons I love alcohol-free beer is that it was a crutch for me in those occasions initially where I was feeling the awkwardness of, like, hold on, I'm at a bar and I don't have a beer. The alcohol-free beer sort of quietened that weird, that voice in my brain, and made me realise, oh, I'm actually just in a bar, it doesn't matter. Yeah. And for anyone who loves wine, because alcohol-free wines tend to be not very good, although that might be changing... I think this would be a great alternative for someone who's looking for that. What can I have that's just going to like almost placebo effect on my brain while I get over the initial hump of awkwardness into it becoming my new normal? Because it does become your new normal. Like, not drinking in bars is so not a problem for me now. I don't even think about it, but in the beginning it can be tricky.
Well, I think there's two things, aren't there? There's certainly the perception of having something to drink. I always found that if you were able to pour something into a wine glass, the questions don't happen because nobody sees that you're just having a Coke or whatever. So you don't have to deal with that sort of social pariah status.
Yeah.
And then there's the as you say, the sort of slight placebo effect of having something that to sort of just calm your own nerves, I suppose, around your own anxiety. But the third thing is, I think if you don't drink alcohol, and a lot of people find this, even if they're not drinking alcohol because they're pregnant or they're designated driver or whatever, the options that you've always traditionally had are dull. So you have...
Dull.
Yeah, you have one orange juice.
I hate orange juice as well. Like, really?
Orange juice, sparkling water.
Coke.
I'll throttle the next person who gives me any elderflower.
So, I actually quite like elderflower, I have to say.
Well, I'll have the orange juice, you have the elderflower. the idea of having something that's complex, sophisticated, interesting, in flavour profile as much as anything else, is where we've been missing.
Yes, and it's a similar, and I know that, you know, having been kind of like a plant curious eater for around the similar time, you know, you start to feel a bit like a second class citizen and a bit pissed off about, like, oh, another risotto, great. Like, it's just, and that again can be off-putting if you really want to make a sustainable change. It's like, God, the future of my eating out contained to, like, you know, choosing the one thing off the menu I don't really want.
It's just a bit miserable.
Absolutely. And while you're back in London, well, if you can find a way to eat the cooking of Joey O'Hare, okay. I think she's pretty interesting. Well, at the moment she doesn't work in it. She used to do pop-ups, so at the moment you would just have to go and knock on her door and beg her. But she writes recipes, and she's very much about fermentation, so using things like kombucha to actually replace those sort of animal, you know, she talks about how animal meat under heat does interesting things, and that's what we like about it. And
yes.
And vegetables don't. But actually, if you use fermentation, you can bring some really interesting flavours out there as well. And the other one that I was just chatting to and interviewing the other day, we'll put the video of this out on Friday, is a bloke called Jamie Park. And he cooks around the corner from here in a place called The Frog, which is in Dalston Square. The Frog is a normal, you know, it's a very kind of cutting-edge Michelin restaurant, but it is very at the forefront of trying things out. And, you know, as he says, he wants vegans and veg-centric people to come in there and just be blown away by what they can do with this stuff. So that's where you should go.
Yes, indeed. And it's really exciting to see those sorts of things happening in food as well. And there are definitely some great veg... There's a restaurant in New York called Dirt Candy. Okay. If you ever come over, you should check it out. It's proper kind of... You know, it's got the Michelin star look and feel, and it's all vegetables. And you just wouldn't... They do these, like... Do you know what sliders are?
No.
Sliders are what Americans call mini hamburgers.
Okay.
And they do these carrot sliders. Oh. They come in these little brioche buns. I mean, I don't know how they do it, but...
Well,
yeah,
this is
spectacular.
This is what's exciting about the world at the moment.
And this is what I mean about the more of us you start asking for what we actually want... the more innovation will happen, you know, the more choice there will be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to meet you.
This week's Real Podcast was brought to you, as always, by Real Kombucha, non-alcoholic fermentation at its finest. Our thanks, of course, go to this week's guest, Ruby Warrington. Make sure you buy her book, Sober Curious, available now at all good bookstores. Our thanks also to the Drift Bar for their hospitality during the interview. And we'll see you again in the next couple of weeks for more great foodie and modern drinking podcasts. Check out our other content on www.realkombucha.co.uk/blog.